Well, I'd like to welcome you very warmly to this debate this afternoon, and we're very privileged to have some fantastic speakers. I don't know if many of you know about Just Share, but we are a coalition of churches and other agencies who seek to promote dialogue about issues of global and economic justice. And the issue of fair trade is obviously very topical at the moment. Our next debate is in September, and we've got a website which is justshare.org.uk, if you log on to that, you'll be able to sort of keep updated as to our events, which are usually the debates every 6 to 8 weeks, but we've got a bit of a break over the summer, so the next one will be in September. I'd like to hand over to our chair, Stephen Beer, who works in the city, and he's employed by the Methodist Church to manage their investment of equities and their portfolio in that. So, welcome.
Thank you. Friends, thank you very much for the opportunity to chair today's meeting. The title is Fair Trade Really Fair? We know that the economists tell us, and in fact I'm one myself, that increased trade has brought greater prosperity around the world over the many years. But does that also produce costs? Well, it does. There are clear costs to globalization development. And arising out of that has come a move to look at what fair trade as well as free trade really means. So this is what we're going to debate today. We're going to hear from our two speakers who, as usual, we've stuck up in the opposing pulpits to encourage them to perhaps be at least slightly opposed to each other for the debate. And then they will speak for about 8 to 9 minutes, and then we'll take a series of questions from the floor, and then we will finish promptly at 5 to 2. So first of all, just to say who the speakers are, in the right-hand corner is Philip Sigley, Chief Executive of the Federation of Cocoa Commerce Limited, and also Chairman of Cocoa Research UK. And in the left-hand corner is Ian Bretman, Deputy Director of the Fair Trade Foundation, which is the organisation behind the Fair Trade labels. So without further ado, while I preside sort of bishop-like in the middle, I will hand over to Philip to kick us off.
Thank you, Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for this opportunity to explore with you the key topic of fair trade and mainstream in relation to the global cocoa trade. Firstly, I'd like to look at the reasons why fair trade in cocoa and chocolate forms a very small part of the global confectionery market. Secondly, why the fair trade lobby may be working against the interests of poor people in cocoa producing communities. And finally, how fair trade and free trade can work together to bring a significant improvement to the lives of millions. Cocoa is principally a smallholder crop with annual global production around 3.5 million tonnes. Production has tripled over the past 30 or so years, and that growth has been achieved by the free market. Over 70% of the world's cocoa is grown in West Africa. Several countries are heavily cocoa and commodity dependent. The largest producer is Côte d'Ivoire, growing around 1.4 million tonnes, about 41% of the world total. Côte d'Ivoire has seen difficult times, and yet despite civil unrest and divisions within the country and some loss of life, the wheels of the mainstream market have continued to turn. Rural communities have been able to sell their output to the international markets. The conditions may not be ideal. There may be middlemen who have taken a portion of the revenue. However, without these middlemen, this cocoa could not have been brought to the market. Why? And there is an extremely important point here. The legitimate private sector will operate to the prevailing social, economic, and political conditions in a country. The risks it will take are very measured, and the free market will find a way if there is one to be found. Whether it is as efficient or rewarding as it could be for certain members of that supply chain is another matter. However, it does provide an opportunity for cocoa farmers, wherever they may be, to gain some reward for their efforts. You will find very little fair trade cocoa, if any, coming from Côte d'Ivoire. In contrast, the mainstream buys $2 billion of cocoa every year from that country, of which a quarter, around $500 million, goes to the state in the form of levies and customs duties. If alternatives to fair trade had not been available, the effect on the 600,000 farmers and the estimated 5 million or so people in the Ivory Coast dependent on cocoa would have been disastrous. Now, next door in Ghana, you will find some fair trade cocoa, but just pay a visit to the cocoa farms operating under a fair trade umbrella and you observe little significant difference in yields and income over the mainstream cocoa business, which in Ghana is still internationally traded through a state marketing board. In terms of receiving a high proportion of the international price for cocoa, farmers in Ghana are better off in any case than farmers in the Ivory Coast. Ghana still has the benefit of the quality control regime, which attracts a premium over other cocoa origins. This system applies to fair trade and mainstream. And so we must conclude that fair trade appears to have chosen its market very carefully. If you take other fair trade origins, for example, Costa Rica and Panama, the prevailing conditions are substantially easier in the main cocoa than in the main cocoa growing countries. I would now like us to reflect on the unfair comparison. If we please consider the position if the private sector was to take on all of the issues that go with compliance with fair trade criteria in Côte d'Ivoire, for example, the cost of doing so would be enormous, since the private sector would effectively have to replace the state in many functions, which would be totally unacceptable to all concerned. In addition, you would effectively create a minimum price for cocoa, which would attract more producers unless quotas or specific supply chain relationships were put in place. The market would be unable to absorb the oversupply, and what happens to the surplus? Is someone forced to buy it? Would this be fair to those who want to and are able to enter into or continue in the cocoa market at a lower cost? Moving therefore to the second part of what I want to say today, that is the unfair aspects of fair trade. Fair trade is an alternative system, and as a system that is an alternative, it does not create any difficulty for the mainstream in terms of a debate as to whether it is fair as a concept. Indeed, it is complementary to other trading systems, and this gives the consumer a genuine choice. I do not propose to go into the debate that Mr. Bretman has with the BBC Two Money programme as to whether farmers get a fair share of any additional premium that's paid by the consumers and the cost of the fair trade labelling system. However, when fair trade supporters seek to impose an unfair tag on everything else, then this suddenly becomes a situation which is very, very serious for farming communities that do not enjoy circumstances conducive to a fair trade type of system. This tag does a great disservice to the mainstream and risks damaging the incomes of rural producers in the most difficult areas, because a stigma becomes attached to a particular commodity or country, whether or not such stigma is justified. Now, child labour has been such an issue, where some so-called fair trade organisations have chosen to deliberately exaggerate the issue for their own political, ideological and commercial ends. They urge consumers to buy guilt-free chocolate, arguing that only through fair trade it is guaranteed as regards the absence of child labour. This is rubbish. The cocoa trade and industry is working hard with the cocoa origins, we have our loyalty there, on the child labour problem in a groundbreaking, creative and supportive way. Other industries would do well to observe and adopt the efforts we are making. Schools, churches and local authorities have been targets of what may be called fair trade propaganda. Effectively, school children, well-meaning local authorities and, dare I say, congregations, are being persuaded to support farmers who are already able to enjoy better conditions than those who are less fortunate and make up the mainstream. Both sides of the debate, we ask, be carefully considered. Please do not get me wrong. I am not saying that trade and industry is operating in every way that it could to address corporate social responsibility, but we do deserve a much better image than we receive by comparing our attempts to deal with millions of farmers with a niche fair trade product. This comparison is too often advanced by governments and donor agencies who find such ideology politically expedient. Regrettably, developed country governments, influenced by naive lobby groups, have made the little effort to understand markets and have joined with the arguments against mainstream to a certain extent. It is easier than having to sit down, after all, and work out the big picture. This could be the subject of a further debate, and we do not have time today. I will just say that the failure of governments and donors to address fundamental measures to encourage trade in developing countries is a major inhibitor to progress. Fair trade, as currently promoted by its supporters, is creating a sideshow to the real issues that need to be addressed to allow the mainstream market to develop in a way that brings maximum benefit to the many, which is, to me, a much more meaningful contribution to fair trade. Now, developed and developing country governments argue that agriculture is vital to achieve alleviation of poverty, and if agriculture is such a key industry for helping people in rural communities, is this being served by not addressing the poor quality of the roads, the non-existent communication systems, and the bigger problem of imported food surpluses? Without the vital infrastructure and facilities in the rural areas, all the spending talk is for nothing. The real mission is to take the good intentions of fair trade and translate them into the real world. There is an urgent need to genuinely make cocoa and cash crops an engine room for growth in the agricultural sector of the countries with which we are concerned. So rather than focus on fair trade as a concept, look at sustainability as the objective. Rather than paying an artificial price for a commodity to be produced in an inefficient way, what can be done to get farmers to increase yields and rehabilitate degraded land? When farmers do earn additional income for their crops, they don't necessarily spend it in their village or invest it in their village. It's not uncommon to find additional funds earned by a farmer used to buy a house in a city and to rent it out. Is this because of demands from an extended family or because donor interventions have made cities far more attractive place to be? And there is a real concern that young people just do not want to work on the farms. This is in part due to donor intervention, investing not in trade in agriculture or in agricultural communities, but in city-based developments and government buildings encouraging urban drift. We have to do better than continue to encourage situations where the best jobs for local people to aspire to are with foreign NGOs. To my final point, I believe the difference in this world that we all seek will come from joined-up thinking and genuine interaction between international business community, the governments of producing countries, the donors and, of course, the farmers and their families, in looking at what interventions will really make a difference and produce a sustainable and just standard of living. Ladies and gentlemen, fair trade and other niche services are a welcome part of our global cocoa market, and we are very happy that consumers have the option to make such choices. However, the mainstream alternatives to fair trade, if properly supported, will achieve far greater impact on poverty and achievement of Millennium Development Goals than some of the narrow focus areas. If there is one thing I would like you to take away from this debate today, it is not to be unfairly prejudiced about the change that sensible activity between governments, donors and trading industry could bring about. Please convince our public sector decision makers to do more in this respect, and that over-reliance on fair trade for the benefit of a few will be massively unfair on millions of poor people in terms of the time taken to reach where we all want to be. Thank you.
Thank you. Over to you, Ian.
Good afternoon. Might surprise you to hear that actually I agree with a lot of what Philip says. I'm sure there's enough in there that I can disagree with to make something of an interesting debate. I certainly hope so. I think the two questions I'm most often asked about fair trade when I talk to business people and economists and people in Philip's line of work, where there seems to be some resentment of what fair trade is doing or how it's perceived. First one is why do we stake a claim to this term fair? Why do we call what we do fair trade? And are we accusing people who work outside of our system, in what it calls the mainstream market, which we prefer to call the conventional market, are we accusing people of acting unfairly when they're simply working within a market system that many people would say is actually the fairest way of dividing the risks and rewards of trade? And I think you can argue, certainly, as paraphrase what Winston Churchill once said about democracy, that even if it's the worst possible system, that only after you take into account all the other possible systems that have ever been invented. And it's true, markets do provide very efficient mechanisms for moving product around the world. And say, even working with fair trade, I believe in markets. What I think they don't do, because they're not designed to do that, is to deliver what we might call social justice. We don't live our lives in economic decisions. We don't do the important things that we consider in life, get married, start a family by looking at figures on a piece of paper and doing a cost-benefit analysis. And I think one of the problems we face in the world today is that, economics has been allowed to move too far outside its box and beyond its role of simply explaining how mechanisms in markets and how trade can work, to telling us that actually we have to live by these rules because there's no alternative. Well, some of us think there is an alternative. Some of us want to live in a world where there is a different way of doing things, and we take other factors into account. And I think more and more people are supporting that, not just through fair trade, but through many other issues that we see in everyday life. But it's also misunderstanding what we mean by fair. And over the years, I've had to look at this because it can be quite a tough argument sometimes. So what do we mean by fair? It's strange word. We use it all the time, perhaps don't think about it very much. If you've got children, you'll probably find that by the time they're three, they'll be able to say, it's not fair, as one of their first phrases. What does that mean? Well, looking at legal theories on this, things that underpin the basis of our laws in this country and many other countries, the two tests really are, is it a fair outcome? And if it's not, what can you do about it? Okay? Well, let's apply that first test to world trade and the state of the world today. Millions of people who depend on producing commodities that are traded internationally are living in poverty. The OECD says that about half of the people in the world who are economically active are living on less than $2 a day. Can anybody describe that as a fair outcome? I don't think so. What can any of us do about this? Well, we have a mechanism for improving the way world trade is managed through the WTO, and for the past 5 years, that's been in the process of delivering what it called at its Doha meeting back in 2001, a development round, a model for world trade that would promote sustainable development. Look in the newspapers this week, you will see that those talks are very likely to collapse and not result in a deal. So does world trade pass the second test of fairness? Given that the outcome isn't fair, people able to do anything about it? Not very much. Fair trade, as we define it, the role of my organization is very simply to see where we can make a difference to that situation by working with consumers, with producers, and with businesses who want to help us. It's actually got nothing to do with companies acting unfairly. We don't accuse companies of acting unfairly. I admit, talking to Philip earlier, that sometimes that is misunderstood by some more radical supporters of fair trade. But if you look very carefully at what my organization says and what our partner organizations say, we're not talking about other trade being unfair. Simply saying, is this a mechanism for making a difference to people? Because an awful lot of people in this country, certainly if you look at the impact of the Make Poverty History campaign through last year, attitudes to poverty are changing. In the past, I think people felt that it was sad but inevitable. You used to hear this phrase, the poor are with us always. I think people now are saying, doesn't have to be like that. Something needs to be done about it. Something can be done about it. And I would also like to be part of that solution if I can. Fair trade, very simply, is a way that we can make a difference through the things that we buy in our everyday lives. And it's a difference in a number of ways. The first, and probably the smallest difference, is actually benefiting the farmers who are behind the products that you buy as fair trade. The rules of the fair trade system that must be met for a product to carry our fair trade mark mean that those products have to come from growers who are certified against our standards. They must receive a fair price. They must receive a premium for investment. But the other impacts of fair trade are on society here, and they're probably even larger. The first is to give a voice to consumers who say, I want to be part of this solution. I want things to be different. And that's a challenge, I think, for businesses, and it's a challenge for governments. And I think both of them are valid. When we launched the Fair Trade Mark, actually 14 years ago, I think it was first announced to the trade, and some of my colleagues went around talking to companies that we thought would want to be part of this. Many major brands and major supermarkets. And people laughed at the idea. They said, well, we've heard of these fair trade products. They're in Oxfam shops. There's this organization, Tradecraft, that sells products in church halls. That's the market for fair trade. They're buying it from you. What makes you think there are people out there who will pay extra or make the effort to move away from the products they're used to buy a product in a supermarket that the only benefit on that product is that it will help somebody who they've never met, who lives on the other side of the world, who they never will meet. And we said, we think that if that message is put out, people will do it. Well, last year, nearly 10 million households bought a fair trade product at least once last year. That's about 40%. Most of them bought very few. Account in fair trade for about 7 or 8% of the banana market, about 5% of the coffee market. I don't think our impact on the chocolate market actually registers. And it's quite interesting that chocolate is one of those products that most of what we buy in this country comes from a small number of very large manufacturers. None of them are selling fair trade. Not quite sure why, because when you look at the coffee market, we gradually built up a roster of brands that have fair trade as part of their range, to the extent even that last year Nestlé launched a fair trade product, recognizing consumer support for this. But in chocolate, we haven't got that, and it's noticeable that our market share in chocolate is extremely low. But I still think that it's worth doing. And I think it's worth doing because the farmers who are behind it tell us that it's worth doing. Philip said, we reflecting the relative base of sales in the market, we don't work with as many cocoa producers as we do with coffee or bananas. But where we do, we are making a difference. In Ghana, the Kwapa Cocoa Cooperative has nearly 40,000 cocoa farmers that it is helping to get a better life. And it's not about working with fair trade or with the conventional market. Only about 4% of what Kwapa sells goes to the fair trade market at the guaranteed minimum price. But the work that fair trade organizations have done with them, as well as the work that companies like Cadbury's have done with them, it's not just us, but that model of developing a cooperative that is owned and is accountable back to its members is enabling them to actually deliver a better future to all of their members. So I really don't think that fair trade has to be seen as something that is quite separate. In fact, it tends to work much better when it is integrated into the mainstream market, both in the market side, which is what we're seeing now. I think we can say with some legitimacy that fair trade is mainstream because it's sold by many big brands, it's in all our major supermarkets. That to me means mainstream. We'd like it to be more mainstream in terms of how we work with the supply side around the world, because I think we could do much more together. And so, for me, the questions about where we go from here is how do we work with business to scale this up, to learn the lessons that we have from the value of the fair trade movement, and to build on the consumer support and the increasing consumer support for people to want to move away from simply a dogmatic free market approach to see if we can really make trade work as a means of solving poverty, to be part of that broader coalition. And I really think that is possible, and I'd like to make sure that we have a good understanding with people in the cocoa industry, that they recognize that we are willing to talk to them and we are willing to respect their views as well, recognize the value of what they do on a much larger scale, to see if we can develop a partnership for what we really have in common. Because as much as business people that I've spoken to over the years disagree about fair trade, when you actually get behind the jargon, behind the labels that are put on things, what we're all actually concerned about is solving poverty. And I've never met anybody who doesn't want to do that. Thank you.
Thank you to both our speakers. And so fair trade is useful, but ignores the main event, which is what's going on outside the fair trade universe. And we should focus much more on that. Or actually, fair trade is doing a great deal for its suppliers and for the people down the supply chain, something we should support. But we're both united on the ultimate aims. Friends, do we have any questions? Now's that time. Any questions to put to our speakers? Yes, with a roving mic heading your way.
Good afternoon. I think one thing a lot of people in the audience would like to know, given the basis of fair trade, is that more of the producer receives more money than otherwise. Sorry, I'll start again. I think a lot of people in the audience would like to know, having heard that when you buy your coffee or cocoa or whatever from fair trade, more of the money goes to the producer than would otherwise be the case. But I think a lot of us are unclear as to how much more, and perhaps some kind of example numbers would help.
Okay, thank you. So the question there was, what sort of proportion of fair traded, when you buy your fair trade product, what sort of proportion goes to the producer? Ian, I think that's primarily one for you.
Yes, well, fair trade standards do set a minimum price for the crop that is sold by the farmer or the farmer organization. So coffee beans in the case of coffee, cocoa beans in the case of cocoa. Because even under fair trade, I have to say that represents a very small part of the finished price of the product we buy. We do publish those prices. They are available. Cocoa, the minimum fair trade price is $1,600 per ton, with an extra payment of what we call the fair trade premium of $150 per ton. So the cocoa fair trade, under fair trade terms, cocoa will never fall below $1,750 a ton, and it will always be at least $150 above the market price. That is quite complicated, and the extra that goes back to farmers actually doesn't depend on us. It depends on what the market price of cocoa is. So it's a figure that we don't often focus on in our communications, because of the fact that it does change at different times. What we can guarantee is that farmers are always getting more than they would get on the conventional market. And the real benefits to farmers are not just on the price, but also in the different trading relationships that they have with fair trade, the stability that it offers. And what we hear when we talk to farmers is that those things are just as important, if not more important, than the headline price.
Presumably, another way of looking at it is to sort of ask, what can farmers in different countries actually purchase with the funds they get from, if you like, the profits that they get any from their product? I mean, is that an argument you would make, that's a better way of looking at things rather than an absolute figure?
I think from our experience, you've got the taxation policy of the countries concerned, which has a huge bearing on what the farmers receive. For example, in Côte d'Ivoire, the farmers receive somewhere around £300 a ton, and it's trading today on the markets at about £1,000 a ton. Now, if you go to Cameroon, which is an inferior quality cocoa, they're getting £650 a ton because the state is not involved. And there's a lot of issues there where, if that difference was actually spent on developing the infrastructure and communities, there would be some benefit. Now, in terms of the question that was asked, could I just answer that, Chairman? There is a big difference in what goes back to the farmer, but not so much in cocoa. I think in cocoa, Dare Chocolate Company and Divine, they're actually working extremely hard to do their best for those farmers. There are other fair trade products where your questions are very well positioned, because there is a big difference in what goes back, and I think consumers would like to know how much of what they spend as an additional actually does go back there. And I've seen very small figures going back for some coffee products, large amounts going back for some bags of sugar, etc. But the jury is out as to just how effective that system is.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Yes, one at the back there.
Thank you both very much for interesting presentations. My question to you is, given the way that markets always pursue the lowest price to source products, and essentially that obviously has human implications, what is your vision for how markets could change? Where do you see that there's a need for public policy and how trade is done, perhaps to put those safeguards in? You spoke a little bit about the Child Labour Project, but I kind of think the way that markets work at the moment is unsustainable and we've got to move towards public policy, and I'd be interested in your ideas as to what could be done.
I think so. If markets don't work exactly well now, and if we're not going to pursue fair trade, how can they be made to work?
Okay, interestingly, we have quite a large project with some major chocolate manufacturers who don't want to take risks in difficult countries, so we found people to take those risks in Côte d'Ivoire, and they are working with some cooperatives. We're trying to get that moving. Now, our idea would be you don't set a minimum price because this will create problems, but what we will try and do is come to some price differential over and above the market in exchange for attributes for the product. For example, we are looking at one particular relationship where one of the largest manufacturers is actually including a social component in the money that's paid back to the farmers group. But this has, I mean, some of the origins do not like this because they think it's colonialism, but what's actually taking place is that the farmer, the trade house that's taking the risk, and the chocolate manufacturer that's paying the extra money are sitting down together to work out how the money was spent, should be spent. And I'll give one example. For example, instead of going into one of these unsustainable, you know, NGO projects, we actually put in place a road grader which would repair these roads. I mean, if I've been going to West Africa for 30 years, and I think things in many respects are going worse than they were when I started in Nigeria in 1976. And we have to ask ourselves, where is all the development money going? And I think in that money from the development agencies, the governments themselves, and the partnership with the mainstream, to me, it will be the solution where we can make real changes for those communities. But we are trying.
So Ian, the markets are actually benign. They just need a bit of an encouragement. What's your take?
Well, as I said, I think we do need to rethink our approach to markets and bring in other values as well. Again, I'm impressed by what Philip is saying, but and it's not a million miles away from fair trade. I think the key difference is that we feel that these things should work with the farmer organisations in the same way that we do, to enable them to have more control over these processes. It just seems to me there is something wrong with a market. If a valuable product, commodity, like cocoa, doesn't deliver sustainable livelihood to the people that produce it. And I think we have to ask that question and put out that challenge as to how that can be dealt with, because I think what is untenable in the long term, much as I admire the programs that many of the chocolate companies have with their social projects in cocoa-producing countries, it just seems wrong to me that those farmers who are producing the product should be depending on charity for their schools, for their wells, but even for their roads. And I think that's a challenge for all of us to try and change that.
Any more questions? Yes, just there at the back.
Hello, Ian. I'm just wondering if you see any limit to the penetration of fair trade in particular product categories, and I think it goes down to a comment that Philip made earlier on about oversupply. I mean, is fair trade, does it act actually as a, it's probably not the right term, but, you know, the best practice that sets elements in the marketplace that companies and other initiatives should follow? Or, you know, what are the consequences of fair trade in certain categories, maybe reaching 60, 70, 80% penetration for producers, and is that sustainable?
Well, and basically, how sustainable is it to move up? The question will correct me if I got this wrong, but in terms of moving up fair trade through different products or perhaps increasing its penetration in certain products, I can't remember the figure you had for coffee. I think it was something like 5% penetration. Well, what if it was 50%, 60% plus? Is that a sustainable world that we could live in? Would it work? I think that was...
Well, I think what we have to do is separate out the core principles behind fair trade, which I think don't change, and the way that we deliver that in terms of standards. So the prices that we set at the moment, the rules that we set for eligibility for producers to participate in fair trade, are based on what we can achieve at the current scale of market penetration. There is nothing, my understanding of this, and having worked with the Fair Trade Foundation for 10 years and actually been involved with different organisations in this field for nearly 20, that doesn't suggest that everybody in this area would be open to discussions with the major traders, the producing governments, the farmer organisations themselves, to ask the question of, well, how would it work best if it was 10% or 20%? So I think it can evolve and adapt. As long as I think the challenge also for us, in the same way that that free trade is a very good principle, but if you take an over-dogmatic approach to it, you can end up actually having a lot of, I think what Philip referred to as unintended consequences, and I recognise that we have to be careful on that as well.
Philip, I couldn't help sort of thinking, listening to you, that, I mean, hear the stuff that's said about fair trade and the links with the producers, but I couldn't help almost join to sort of caricaturise your position as being almost... buying fair trade goods is great, but really it's a sort of indulgence almost, which seemed quite a harsh, you know, your ideal penetration almost might be 0% and we put our effort somewhere else. That seemed quite a harsh thing to say.
I'm a very harsh person when you get to know me. I think the point about penetration, this, what Ian was saying before, that, you know, charity, it is not charity that we're talking about. What people can't experience is when you take a vehicle from upcountry Ivory Coast to the port and there are 6 roadblocks and there's money being demanded, there's problems, there's this. Cocoa is a very, very difficult business. Now, and I go back to saying, you then have to choose your market, which has been excellently done by Fair Trade. We've targeted the easiest markets to work in to bring benefits. We're working with the most difficult. Now, if people want a differentiated product and they want to feel better, I have no problem about that at all. And I said in my presentation, put both sides of the argument, and I don't have any problems, but my problem is with governments who've been convinced to talk against mainstream. Even UNCTAD, the UN, you'll hear niche, this is the way forward. Now, in terms of focusing people's minds on a concept, it's fantastic, but the huge picture is there that maybe, and what we are saying to our farmers is, don't grow more cocoa. You don't look at other diversification into exotic fruits. So we have farmer field schools. Again, the funding is very limited. We could do a lot more, but the governments are simply not behind this initiative. Now, if we did that, there'd be lots of other things that would be, you know, other products that would come to market, which would be, you know, quite helpful to those communities. But then you come back to, again, on the big picture, the US and the EU sending, you know, huge amounts of foodstuffs into West Africa. There's no incentive to produce it themselves, and they've got all the land. So, you know, there are those major issues. Is it an indulgence? If people want to spend their money, that's fine. But please, let's just put over the position in a fair way from the fair trade lobby. And I accept that many people in the fair trade organisation are not the... All I would say is that they have been infiltrated by those that want to create mischief for the mainstream market.
Okay, more questions. let's take a couple at a time. So we'll work our way forward. Just those two rear rows, that'd be great.
It seems to be important to do as much processing as possible in a developing country just to increase work. I lived in Papua New Guinea for some years and I bought and I drank perfectly well-packeted coffee grown and produced instant and filter in Papua New Guinea for the sort of elite market for Australians and people who could afford it. But we ourselves grew a lot of cocoa and I spent a lot of time husking cocoa and taking it to the fermentary. I processed myself some and managed to make some rather inedible cocoa buns. It seems to be a much more difficult crop to deal with, but is it ever going to get to the point where decent, edible chocolate could be produced in a country like Papua New Guinea for export, or is it a much more difficult crop than cocoa, than coffee?
Okay, thank you. Let's take the next question as well. So that question was sort of, is it possible to sort of produce, rather than just produce the basic material, if you like, is it possible to produce the actual foodstuff, the chocolate sort of, or what have you, in the country where the foodstuff originated from and export? Yes.
Thank you. It's more an observation, really, than a question. I'm quite a fan of the whole CSR movement, as I'm sure everyone else here is. And I'm very aware that the argument for CSR by large companies is that it does raise standards. And there are many examples from big companies that go to developing countries, big companies that go to developing countries, and they argue that through their CSR initiatives, they can improve the quality of water, they can provide better working facilities, they can even provide HIV/AIDS testing and treatment. So I'm not anti-big business. But inevitably, large companies going to developing countries on a mass scale often results in the closure of small-scale farms, with implications for small-scale farmers. As I understand it, really the fair trade movement is really about ownership, and that's the difference. It's not between fair and unfair business, but it's about ownership, encouraging local farmers to take ownership of their own businesses. And this actually has a greater impact on a sustainable impact on the ownership of the country. Once you don't worry about where your next meal is coming from, you have the time to participate in a political process. Once you have money to take your child to school, you can put demands on your government for improving the education and health system. So my observation really is that it's not about fair and unfair. Really, it's about ownership, which has a much greater and more sustainable impact of ownership of a country.
Thank you very much. So isn't it really about ownership, small farmers actually maintaining their stake in their country, and that the profits from that sort of circulating around to the benefit of that country as a whole? And the question before that, of course, was the export. Can't countries export the final products? Let's go to Ian, I think, first.
Thank you. Yes, I think two questions have a lot of common ground on them. And again, I would come back to this point about being clear about principles, but then having some flexibility about how they're implemented. Yes, of course, part of the problem, or one aspect of the problem for developing countries, is that they generally produce commodities and they don't share in the added value process. I'm sure it's one of the things that together, not just in the fair trade movement, but working with industry and working with farmers, we need to change. In parts of the fair trade movement, that is happening. I know of coffee cooperatives in Central America that have taken on the roasting of coffee and are now selling a product into the United States market that is their own product. Similarly, in this country, we have that model developed with Cafe Direct, Day Chocolate Company, Agrifair, where the fair trade businesses that are part-owned by the farmer organizations. And I think both of those achieve the same objective, which is helping farmers share in the ownership of their product further downstream, to hopefully share in the financial rewards of that, those added value processes, but also to get closer to the market and to understand more how the market works and to be able to make better decisions about their core operations. Where I think it goes too far, to be honest, is if you start pushing people in some of the African countries to actually make the chocolate there. I'm not sure that would be the most efficient way of doing it. Maybe in the long term, but at the moment, to be honest, I would much rather see farmers selling good volumes to companies like Cadbury's and Mars and having that market than trying to compete with that and taking on costs that they probably wouldn't cover. I think it would be a very, very painful process to learn how to do that. And I certainly, what I don't want to do is to be pushing farmers to take those decisions. If they are able to make their own decisions, if they're able to get more understanding of how the market works, and they can look at the costs and benefits and the risks and rewards of taking on other processes, and they make their decision, that's fine. But I think we do have to be careful about being over dogmatic and saying this has to be the way to go.
Thank you. And Philip, I mean, is it the case that big business basically economically and politically disenfranchises the farmers in these countries?
Definitely not. If I take the question on processing, first of all, because coffee can be, I mean, I used to be involved in coffee in Costa Rica, and six farms that we had fed into one beneficio, one mill. And it was a clean, large-scale operation. It worked very well. The contrast in West Africa with cocoa is, we're talking 600,000 farms producing 1.4 million tons. That is very, very low efficiency, but it is bringing money to the market. Now, where do we add our subsidized milk and sugar to the cocoa? And that is the problem. So basically, you do find processing, for example, maybe in some countries now, there is a drive to do as much processing as possible to actually take the cocoa powder, cocoa butter, or cocoa nib, which is obviously less transport cost. But basically, the production of chocolate in those countries is going to be quite difficult. Now, for example, in Cameroon, very little Cameroon cocoa is used directly for itself in chocolate because it's a soft butter which is mixed in with other butters in Amsterdam or UK or wherever. So there are many more technical, let's say, functions. If you think there are 70, 80, 100 different types of cocoa powders from one manufacturer, it's going into ice creams and biscuits. There's a huge market there which would not work. And I think also for those countries that have gone for local processing, they've found that it hasn't been the actual labour generator they thought. So investment has come in, and they maybe can run a plant doing tens of thousands of tons with a few people. Now, the bigger issue, I think there's a book called Brand New Justice, which I've read a couple of times, and the money is actually in the brands. And I think this is where, and we come to the ownership slightly later, but it's in this area about the long-term value and protection and risk management of brands that I think the change will evolve. Which brings me to the ownership situation. Now, we are part of...
Can I just slightly interrupt you, because I'm aware of time, and I want to just get one final question in and ask you to answer that disenfranchised question in your summary. So, can we just grab this one last question, because I'm aware of our time. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
On the question of ownership, now, we've got the brands issue. The brands have been owned for, as we say, donkey's years by the manufacturers. Now, where we could look at the ownership and where it is an important issue is this farm-to-port situation. Now, because the chocolate manufacturers actually don't want to be in beans, buying beans, it's too much of a headache, it's too risky, there's too much exposure, so the cocoa trade and the cocoa processing industry, not chocolate manufacturers, these are the transformers of beans into cocoa butter, cocoa powder, where they come into their own. Now, it's in that situation where, through the Sustainable Tree Crop Programme, of which I'm on the steering committee and have been since it was started in the 90s, we are looking at farmer ownership and where farmers are empowered to deal with buyers. And I think we look at it rather like that they have the best equipped as they can be to deal with buyers. And to give you some concept on that, I recently looked at some prices in some of the regions of Côte d'Ivoire. In one region, there was a difference of between £250 a ton received by one farmer to nearly £400 a ton in the same area. Now, this is to do with access, who comes past the door, who needs money at the time for school fees, all the things that you mentioned. Now, this is not so much a failure of markets, it's a failure of infrastructure to actually move things through to central or some sort of selling or marketing function. Now, many years ago, because I work with the live futures market as well, we know about exchanges, we know about the technology of how to disseminate information. And that I'd love to be able to find some backers in government to say, let's try and do something like that, because it's not only cocoa that you would put on that mainframe, it would be coffee, the other products that can be traded locally, nationally, regionally, internationally. And this is a function of technology which nobody seems to want to take that extra step.
Thank you. Well, Ian,
that will give the farmers ownership. I'm sorry.
Would you like to give a 30-second summary of your position?
Do my best. Well, I think as I started out by saying, there's a lot that Philip said that I agree with. I hope that some of the things I've said have resonated with him, and I think it's quite clear that if we are to be more successful with fair trade, we need to work better with some of the larger operators in trade and industry. But also, I think they have to work better with us. It does take two to tango. I think it's very clear that there's growing consumer demand for fair trade, and that seems to me to be an opportunity for all of us to do some good in the world.
Thank you, Ian. Philip, a 30-second summary? that's the speaker I like. Well, friends, thank you very much for coming, and thank you to Just Share for organising what has been a very stimulating debate. I'm sure you might be able to grab some of the speakers as before they leave. And thank you also to St Mary-le-Bow for hosting this. And so perhaps you might care to join me in thanking our speakers, Philip and Ian, for the excellent contributions they've made. Thank you.
Can I just say as well that we have recorded this debate, and there are some sign-up sheets at the back if you'd like either to receive our email bulletins, or if you'd like to be sent a CD, you're very welcome to put your name and address down, and I will get those out in the next week or so. I'd also like to just highlight an event that's happening here next Tuesday. You might have noticed the carpets and various photos of Afghanistan. And it's an exhibition that's being put on by Afghan Aid and Afghan Action. And they are doing a seminar next Tuesday from 1 o'clock on Afghanistan. And anyone who's interested to come to that and to meet people who work for that charity would be very welcome indeed. And it's here, yeah. Great, and thank you very much for coming.